Joe, how you doing?
This is like that. I'm sorry. Let's start over again. Sorry.
Joe, how you doing?
I'm doing fine. I'm broadcasting from beautiful New Zealand.
Are the Kiwis fresher there?
You know, the Kiwis are fresher here, as a matter of fact. I learned a new word today, climacteric, which means that there are some fruit which can be picked and mature off of the vine.
Mm-hmm.
That's what that word would indicate, and others are not. Other fruit, is this? It's like an orange. It's only as sweet as it is when it's picked. And kiwi is the fruit that can ripen after you pick it. So they ship it overseas, but the ones here in Russia for sure, and we've been enjoying them. It's there's tremendous food here. The fish, the beef, the fruit and vegetable are all good. One thing I would mention is that the dairy is just spectacular here. They have really healthy cows. They don't have any feedlots, and so you get the milk and cheese, and God forbid the ice cream. It's all delicious. So I recommend this place. I think it's a cool place to vacation.
So it's only what 12,000 miles away? How far?
Well, it's less than that. It's a 12-hour flight from LAX, from Los Angeles. And so it's I've been in this emotional fall with my community being the fires have been threatening, and we've been evacuated 3 times, and we thought we were out of the woods, and then like 4 days ago it rained, and there was the worst flood in the history of Montecito, Santa Barbara, and it just wrecked the place. 2,500 homes, 500 or more are either completely ruined or severely damaged, so it's a real blow. And it's hard to watch it basically on the internet and on television.
Mm-hmm.
And this our community. We knew people who have perished and who have been injured, and lots of people who lost their homes. And so it's, very strange time. Surrealistic because, here in New Zealand, they have beautiful rivers and waterfalls and these kind of jungle walks. And so we were taking one of them going out to this waterfall. And that's when we started getting phone calls about what was going on. And I actually talked to a friend of mine very shortly after he had been plucked out of his house, emergency crews using cables that were attached to a telephone pole and winched across a river of rolling boulders and mud.
Wow.
And he said he very nearly died. And, stories like that coming in as we were walking along this little fairy tale stream, mm-hmm. with the waterfall at the end, and the juxtaposition between the horror and the beauty was, reminded me of the juxtaposition of the illusion of democracy and the reality of the secret society that, mm-hmm. we talk about on the show so much. But even more so in terms of juxtaposition is the, in my opinion anyway, is the fantasy that people have about colleges and universities in America, and then the reality. The reality is sort of like the boulder-strewn mudslide that sweeps everything out into the ocean. And the fantasy would be, liberal arts education that takes you to a career where you can have early retirement. And I don't know. Now, Tim, you really must be someone that has strong opinions about college, because I guess you have that on your to-do list with your family coming right up.
A few years away, supposedly, I guess, if they decide to go, if I decide to send them. I don't know what the situation will be like in a few years. As of now, I do have nieces and nephews that have gone on to college. Some have graduated, some are still there, accruing debt. And pretty soon they'll have to graduate, and they'll have to recover from 4 years or 5 years of college education and somehow figure out how to pay off all the money they've borrowed to pay for this four-year excursion in their whatever you want to call it. But as of now, I think right now the student population, college student population in the United States right now is around 18 million, attending about 400 to 500 degree-granting institutions. Of course, the big question is college still worth it? I was reading an article about that written by Walter Williams. And he writes in it, according to the National Conference of State Legislatures, when considering all first-time undergraduates, studies have found anywhere from 28 to 40% of students enroll in at least one remedial course. That's basically they have to take a remedial course in order to get into the college. Community college is about 50% have to take a remedial course. The situation is more bleak when you consider black students and Hispanics. Just about 5% of black students and 13% of Hispanic students met readiness requirements for the subjects of English, reading, math, and science. And the U.S. Department of Education study found that 58% of students who do not require remediation earn a bachelor's degree, compared to only 17% of students enrolled in remedial reading and 27% of students enrolled in remedial math. Of course, what those numbers really show is just how bad the high school education is. Basically, they're graduating people who really are not academically prepared to go to college, much less probably not academically prepared to graduate from high school. It gets more, the corruption of college education gets more exposure if you think like the college sports. If you think of universities as a academic institution, University of North Carolina scandal. There was a learning specialist hired to help athletes. Learning specialists hired to help athletes found that during the period of 2004 to 2012, 60% of the 183 members of the football and basketball teams read between fourth and eighth grade levels. About 10% read below the third grade level. These are students with high school diplomas, and they were admitted in the University of North Carolina. Of course, I think you and I both know that a lot of these athletes are just ringers brought in to bolster the sports program, particularly basketball and college football, because those are the big money makers. So it's really corrupt there. But overall, again, college education itself, the cost has exploded. I think the student debt is 1.2. There are about 42 million college graduates owning $1.3 trillion in student debt. Of course, they're not going into a rather healthy job market, nor are they getting the salaries that enable them to pay off that debt, much less buy a home, start families, and leave what was considered what was considered the American dream. So that's the situation now. Colleges offer fraudulent educations. They're admitting students that aren't prepared because they want to boost the numbers, because the students are borrowing money, government guaranteed loans to enrich these institutions, and they're going heavily in the debt. And I think the Department of Education itself collects hefty interest payments as a profit making venture now. So that's the rundown. That's how I see it now. The numbers, they just don't add up anymore, do they?
I was laughing while you were talking. I mean, you really brought up a nut point when you were talking about that the football players are simply ringers, that are brought in. And because my thought was, well, the students are the ringers. they've been brought in to give the impression that there's like an education going on, because they have these bodies, that are basically enrolled. So the statistics that you were giving, as far as, what percentage of the student population basically needs remedial help, and these would be in skill level kinds of traits like reading, writing, you know, and math typically, right? So they need this remedial skills. But if the standards are not met, and these standards are artificially low to start with, then really it's about twice those percentage, or maybe even three times if you get close to 100%, really are not at some kind of skill level that what can be honestly described as college level skill courses can take place. In other words, your reading just isn't good enough to do what would be regarded as, you know, high level or college level courses and things like, I don't know, you know, literature or writing courses, things like this. You just aren't there. And so first of all, the education system in the United States is exposed by those statistics, right? It just shows that okay, so the kids aren't really ready. Half of the kids in the schools are not really prepared for college, and that and so these are the remedial skills that would be needed. But beyond this, I would point out that kids aren't tested in logic. They are not tested in determining logical fallacies. And to me, these would be the critical skills for an education, right? This has to be job number one of someone training kids to be able to, you know, be successful in life. And I would bet that if you did give logic tests and tests for, you know, which kids could determine fallacies, logical fallacies, I don't think 1 in 100, you know, would really be at a level that would be regarded as proficient by people who study these things. I would be surprised if it was 1 in 100. And so American education doesn't do skill training, or certainly doesn't do it well, and doesn't do logic training at all. And so when you get to college and you're about willing to, you know, pay your whatever it is, $200,000 for the privilege, you have to ask yourself, what is the purpose of this? You know, why are we even bringing 18 and 19 year olds into this situation when they don't have any capacity for logical thought or training in it, and they don't have remedial skills? Wouldn't this be where they should head? I mean, so that's the first thing about college, Tim, is my opinion is that until we can pass students onto a high level of logic and writing and math skills that would enable them to go on to the so-called college level, why do we even send kids to these places, Tim? Why don't they do a U-turn and head them back toward the remedial kinds of education?
Well, I think the answer to that, I think there's several answers to that question. One is, I think, is just sheer inertia. I think for the longest time, at least in the minds of most parents, it's this is what you did to advance socially or to maintain your status. I went to college. By golly, you're going to college, or you're the first one in our family to go to college. And for a generation or two, this was a symbol of upward mobility, particularly right after the Second World War. You had the GI Bill, and that was the first time that college population really did explode, particularly in the 1950s. Then in the 1960s, because of the demographics, because of the baby boom, the first round of baby boomers were becoming college-aged, and they were going. And you had the economy at the time could support it. And also, you had an explosion of these state-run institutions, the California university system, things like that. So you had these large institutions that were expanding greatly, and you had the customer base, so to speak, for it, because you had all these kids going. Having a college degree meant that you could get a comfortable middle-class job and buy a 1,800 to 2,200 square foot home in the suburbs and afford a car, perhaps a second car, these things. And it just the way it was done. And that was, there was some corporation or some large company willing to hire you if you had that BA or your BS or something. So that's such a large part of it. But the problem is, and this is, it just, I think this issue of remedial training speaks to this, is that, the college level courses in the 1940s or 50s were of a higher standard, that simply a large majority of the college-age population simply wouldn't qualify, and they weren't college material, so to speak, and perhaps there's something better for them to do, like get employment, and just, they can do coursework outside of a formal institution. They can read, learn on their own, and get very productive jobs. You don't need to go to college for these to learn. So what they did is they gradually lowered the standards to more or less dumb things down to meet the standards of the of this huge, increase in the college population. So they had to lower the standards, and so they had grade inflation. So you had the overall lowering of standards. So that's why you had the explosion of the college population, in the 1960s. There's money. I mean, obviously, these colleges they were anxious to get the money for the federal insured loans and these things, and the GI Bill, and so they expanded accordingly, and the little bureaucratic or academic empires were built, and all that stuff. An issue that I think you might be very interested in is also the cultural influence of colleges pose, and perhaps they were weaponized, became a conduit for much of the Cultural Revolution, cultural Marxism, because the very time the university system was expanding greatly, these slots are being filled by cultural Marxists. And so radically in the 60s, the environment of colleges changed. They became co-ed. Eventually you get co-ed dorms and these things. And it became an opportunity for the cultural Marxists and the oligarchs and the social engineers to radically change American society the same way they were doing with entertainment and music, they were doing in academics and introducing people to a sort of a degenerate lifestyle. That's why figures like Herbert Marcuse and Wilhelm Reich, who was dead at the time, but he his spirit lived in the on the university, on the campus, and also who was Michel Foucault. And the sexual liberation was advanced greatly. The sexual revolution was fought largely on the college campuses, because that generation would come of age in the 70s and have families, and that's when you saw all the index the indices or measurements for family, family well-being started to break down. So the colleges played their part in the cultural revolution. What do you think about that?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And I think that if you look at the dramatic expansion of the college population, which was being sold as, after World War II and after the Korean War, as basically an increase in the size of the middle class, right? They mm-hmm. were going to find a way to get these people supposedly to better their plot in life. That was how it was sold. That was the workers' paradise.
It's almost like suburbia, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, it's the same thing. Basically. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is that as they give it to the population in the beginning, it does seem to be working. You know, there's in the 50s and 60s, there is this relationship between, the first one in the family to go to college mm-hmm. and then a social advancement, right? There seems to be this direct connection to college degrees and financial success and also cultural success, right? But as we saw, for example, with the Hays Code, the production code, where, it provided a cover for a dramatic expansion mm-hmm. of the facility that the oligarchs could eventually use for mind control, which in this case was the movie theater. And then once the build-out had been completed, then the moral structure of the code was, swept away, and suddenly you had, different kinds of movies, pornographic-type movies popping up everywhere. I think the same thing happens here. I think that they built out the university system, created cultural planks, cultural platforms, so that people would look to college as avenues for financial advancement, but this had nothing to do with what they really had in mind for these structures ultimately. And ultimately, it's what we have today, in which there's almost no relationship whatsoever between skill training that will be something to help a person financially. And the universities are just more and more mind control devices, right? They're more transparently mind control devices. And so I don't think we got here accidentally. I think if you look, I haven't done a lot of research in this area, I intend to, but if you look at, unfortunately, the people who were like the regents of the University of California during this process, I think you're going to find a really high fraction of dubious individuals and Freemasons, mm-hmm. right? So I think that's a good place to start the research. And what I've found so far is chilling. In fact, it just shows me, and this is I'm not completed here, but my initial opinion is that it's just they had what the UC system has become today. They had in mind in the early 50s when they started to build it out. They expanded. I think they had two schools, and now they have 11. The population has been, is increased 100-fold in that time. And the degree of mind control that the universities represent is also, been increased like that. So basically, when the Frankfurt School and the cultural Marxists talked about the long march through the institutions, I think that, the build out of the American university system, and specifically the one I'm starting to do research in, the UC system, Tim, this was how they did the long march. They first, created a political structure that had power, and then they started to basically create the cultural apparatus and physical plant so that they could put people into these systems. And then start basically shaping the minds that they wanted.
Mm-hmm. And then you have a large, largely captured population, a mass situation, which is what Wilhelm Reich talked about. And this is how you lower people's moral inhibitions. You put them in a mass situation,
right.
Particularly with females, with the co-ed education. The breakdown of single-sex universities was a process of this. Because if you really think about it, if you have an institution of learning, higher learning academics, of that, if you're going to have people 18 to 22, you really should segregate the sexes for obvious reasons.
Well, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, I know.
You're trying to educate.
Yeah, but if you want to create a false environment where these kids are, really not independent because they're living either off their parents or borrowed money, and they do have free time if they're not working, and that's more of a case now because the academic rigors are so low. You're going to have a lot of mass situations where you can introduce sexual degenerate behavior. Of course, that was what they were doing. That's why figures like Wilhelm Reich and Michel Foucault play such a prominent role in the cultural environment of the campus. And you can see I think your point about how the production code helped spread the influence of Hollywood because it kept it benign, let people accept it. Then it was later weaponized. At the same time, they built the infrastructure to create its ability to influence American society, basically having a cinema in every small town, creating the cult of celebrity. The university system, and that, of course, the movies themselves, Hollywood played a big part in breaking out ethnic identity, creating false expectation about life, about how people appear, with the beautiful celebrities and these things. This is going to affect people's outlook on life and also going to make them perennially unhappy with how life really is. This is all part of aspirational marketing and things like that, and psychological warfare. Colleges perform the same function. And that's why I mentioned that it's similar to suburbia, because it was used to create sort of a false prosperity, false upward mobility. It seems to work for a generation or two. So for most people's experiences, this seems to be a model that works. It's what you stick to. You go to college, by golly. But it's a way to break down those ethnic communities, those ties, those traditions that ultimately keep people it protects them, from the oligarchs, from the globalism, the global monoculture that ultimately these universes are creating. These universes became laboratories for social experimentation, both figuratively and also actually, because we all know the role that the military, the CIA, MKUltra, a lot of these universities were, you know, were very involved in this experimentation. And that doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, to the point that they were getting students to volunteer for dosing, or unwittingly getting involved in some sort of experiment, you know, with MKUltra and LSD. But the environment itself was an experiment, and that's how you can broadly understand MKUltra was the mass dosing, not just at the rock concerts. That again, the university environment promoted because the whole, you know, rock music scene, but the overall cultural environment, which then was magnified by mass communication, particularly television and radio and these things. So although maybe a few million people may have attended Woodstock and Altamont and, you know, and Monterey Pop, tens of millions of more were aware of it, bought the records, imbibed the culture, got the T-shirts, wore the tie-dye T-shirts, and imitated what they heard. And that was the mass experimentation which was occurring. And the universe...
John, absolutely. Yeah. Really good point, Tim. And I just wanted to point one thing out to add on to that. Well, you know, we have the MKUltra pay requisitions. They exist. People can study them. And you will see that... I forget the number of universities, but... It would be, I believe, about 40 universities that participated, not less than 40. They participated in different ways, but many of them had dozens of MKUltra programs, right? Now, if you look at the programs, the vast majority of them are basically beneath the ethics of anyone who would be, you know, a non-puppet of the oligarch, right? Because they are just insidious. I mean, the McGill University had experiments that are too hideous to even talk about, right? They're just beyond belief. So, but this went on everywhere. You had, and then all these hospitals that were our training facilities that were also doing MKUltra experiments. Now, these are all facts. And my point is this, did any university ever during this time of the MKUltra experiments raise the red flag and resist? Did a single university resist? And I'm sad to say, Tim, the answer is zero, not one. Now, what does that tell us about the basically the authority structure of the university? Who controls it, right? Since not a single university told the public, alerted the public that human experimentation was going on, that evil mind control stuff was being studied, right? Then we can see that the university is just, in a general sense, it's just a device controlled by the same group which set up MKUltra. This is really what the students are experiencing. And so, you know, when you talk about basically the university as a broadening out of the specific social control and structures, you know, that they have with Altamont and Woodstock, things like this. Yeah, this is exactly right. So this was the 60s. And now when you get to the extreme kind of sexual novelties and sexual social perspectives that are being taught, and you see the kind of intimidation that students are basically subjected to, you can see that basically the college has become just a U.S. college. It can be honestly described as just a big continuation of the MKUltra programs, where the technology was developed, and now it's being manifested.
Yeah, and the political correctness and intolerance that we're witnessing is a, I guess you could say, a implementation of, I think it was Herbert Marcuse's liberal tolerance, where views on the left would be tolerated, views on the right would not be tolerated. And that's exactly where, if you go to college and you're defending traditional morality, now, even this is more than it was maybe 20 years ago when I was there, 20, 25 years ago when I was there. There it was liberal, but if you voice these concerns, you weren't hounded and you weren't, threatened with arrest or expulsion, these things. Now it's getting to the point where if you were to express the pedestrian, public morality that was common maybe 25, 30 years ago, you'd be classified a bigot and you'd be hate speech and you'd be expelled because you don't have freedom of speech. If you voice opposition, if you say you think homosexuality is wrong, or you talk about the problems of feminism, these things, you will be, in many universities, you'll be guilty of hate speech.
Yeah, and so they've created a kind of intimidation that prevents thinking. I think that to lay it out on a conservative liberal spectrum doesn't give someone the whole picture. I think that dialectic has generally just been used as a way to move culture to where they want it to get. They basically have in mind a slave camp, and in the camp you have individuals. You don't have, obviously there's no ethnic connection because that would be almost impossible to enslave without a fight. There's at the end of it, there isn't even sexual identity because again, that could produce families. I mean, I hate to say it, but the real template, the vision of the future that the American college is helping to assist us toward is the one Huxley gives in Brave New World, where you're just going to have a test tube, intellectually stratified, emotional zombies kept controlled by drugs that are under control of a very small group. This is what they've had in mind for at least 100 years, and they are honestly trying to bring that system about.
Yeah, the college campus does... I'm sorry, your microphone was fading out there.
Can you hear me?
Okay, now I can hear you better. Sorry, you were fading out there.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, but you were talking about this Brave New World. The college campus does seem to reflect some of what Huxley wrote about in Brave New World with this, sexual licentiousness, no political freedom, everyone on drugs, not just illegal, not just talking about illegal narcotics. I'm talking about just the, I think it was 25% of college students are on some sort of pharmaceutical or psychotropic drug or something?
Yeah, legally prescribed. Yeah. Psychotropics are the, the tranquilizers. And of course, opium now is just everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And this might speak to maybe, we're talking about cultural Marxism and the moral environment of the university is what should, when a parent is dealing with an 18-year-old who's never been out of the house, particularly a female who's, spent her cloistered in a house somewhere, they're going to send her off to this den of iniquity, a psychological, this indoctrination center where her dignity, her identity is going to be assaulted. And we're wondering why kids are feeling depressed or anxious in a situation like this. Yet all around them, they're told they have to take the SAT, they got to score, high enough to get to the university that they want, and they have to go to the normal routine is to somehow go away from home, 1,000 miles away from home. They've never been out of the house before, and they live in a dorm life situation. It's more often than not co-ed now. Parties everywhere. The atmosphere is completely toxic for a young adult, and just a burgeoning adolescent, really. At least how the kids are raised in this country now, because I think childhood is extended. They do a good job in infantilizing young adults, 16, 17 year olds. Perhaps if we raised our teenagers to be more responsible, this wouldn't be quite the problem, but we don't. But people still, and many, I talked to many adults, and they're aware of what the morals of the situation is like on all these college campuses and the threats they represent to their children. But nevertheless, they insist on sending them because it's still instilled in them that this is the key to social advancement or social stasis, So, they're more or less saying, well, I know that, my daughter's going to come back ruined, but she has to do this to get this degree. For what? Which then again speaks to what expectations people have about life in general in this country. Everyone wants to become a wage, go get a job. You go to college to get a job. You know, what's with that? I mean, you don't have to. I mean, if you want a job, you should probably get an apprenticeship somewhere and seek an education on your own time, become educated. Why this, you know, this fetish for a piece of paper?
Yeah, they've just done a really good job conditioning all culture to want that piece of paper, want that diploma. And basically the diploma, as I would characterize it, is another piece of fiat currency.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, it's a piece of fiat currency that isn't backed by anything because, as you described the statistics at the beginning, you know, so many of the kids don't have any kind of basic fluency in the skills that, you know, would make a difference in the jobs. In terms of jobs, I agree completely. What I would recommend is people not even think about college after high school. Mm-hmm. They should definitely start with a gap year at the least, and in that time do some work and hopefully some apprenticeship into something that they find interesting. And I think that what would happen is one, they might be able to then focus their, you know, period of time between, you know, say 22, 23, when they would enter the workplace, mm-hmm. in terms of what kind of skills they would develop. But moreover, they would develop the emotional strength to keep their soul intact if they do go on to college. Because it's exactly as you described. If you go from high school, where in the last 2 years you're just focused on trying to pass, you know, the SAT or something like that, which at least there, I mean, I will admit there is skill training that goes on, mm-hmm. though not really the kind I would recommend. But, you know, to pass or to you know, successfully, you know, like know how to solve an SAT math problem, mm-hmm. does represent a useful skill. Okay, mm-hmm. I'll give them that. But the problem is that the kids are not growing in any way emotionally. And with the culture they're being exposed to, I think they're very, very vulnerable then to just, you know, mind control when they take their first sociology class or whatever at the university. And so now the oligarchs are able to basically start the brave new world process of stamping their minds with, you know, the code that they want in there. And this is, you know, so we're paying for a kind of process by which we become enslaved. It's crazy. Instead of that, take a gap year. Mm-hmm. Take a gap 2 years, take a gap 3 years, and try to find some kind of skill that you can enjoy that is meaningful to you, and then develop it. You know, one thing that is kind of good about the technological revolution is that people who are good at programming basically found an avenue that was outside of the cultural Marxism that to find employment, because if you were really good at coding, you know, the employers of these tech companies, they didn't care if you'd had a, you know, a degree in English literature or not. They could care less. It was like, well, what's your skill at coding? And so that's kind of the, you know, for those who have a skill at that, I would say that's a, you know, an avenue that you can you know, walk down. But you know what I would say beyond that is just try to, you know, if you're 18 years old, people like that are listening to the show, is the first thing I would say is to honestly ask yourself, what is my skill level in logic? And what is my skill level at the detection of logical fallacy? Mm-hmm. I think this would be the first thing, because, you know, they talk about critical thinking. That's one of the buzzwords of, you know, pedagogy in America. But what do they mean by that? You know, what is they actually referring to? Because I don't see anywhere actual tests of logic. And I think if I was going to, you know, design like an SAT, that would be like the first 50-60% of the tests would be of those skills. I mean, if you can, you know, if you can think clearly like that, then you're someone who's prepared for other kinds of education. And if you're not, you really want to shore that up first. So that would be the first thing. You know, one thing we, you know, it's one thing to criticize and should be done, you know, the American college and university system. But the other thing is, well, what would be the replacement? And, you know, the first thing I would say is to just do an honest assessment, if you're 18 years old, of where you are in terms of your thinking skills. Mm-hmm. You know, what, you know, I don't think that it would be hard really to come up with tests of this. And then if you find that you're really not good in this area, then that's where I would be focusing on. And, you know, at the same time, I think trying to take a year and have employment of any kind would be valuable, because you'd be out in the real world. You wouldn't be in the artificial world of academics, you know, the high school situation. And you'd be developing the emotional strength that hopefully you could apply later on in the real world.
In your ESSA, you're dealing with a real diversity of people, particularly age groups, because you're working,
yeah.
You're learning to take instruction or to deal with other, you know, as you intern or you work at a firm somewhere. You're dealing with all different types of people. That's a great experience, and also you can still pursue academic interests, because especially now, because you know, a lot of these institutions have online courses, so that's an option there.
Exactly.
But there's also the internet. I mean, you have YouTube. You can listen to some of the best lectures after it over and over again. So you know, listen to some professor drone one time in a classroom somewhere. You can listen to some of the best lectures, and then you can supplement those lectures with the reading material and at your own speed, and you know, and you're not under any pressure. You're not cramming for a test. And these things, and we can foster this type of curiosity, or at least this type of expectation academically, through the K-12 process, by somehow thinking about how do we reform that, because that's a whole other topic, because that's where kids really learned to be imprisoned in this system, is the K-12.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. God, thank you for saying that too.
So, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, especially now, with access to information, you just simply don't need the brick and mortar operation or building. You don't need the wide campuses, you know, the taking up expensive real estate and these things. And it just simply isn't necessary anymore. If it ever, you know, ever was, or ever was appropriate for the majority of people to begin with. Again, we're criticizing so-called fraudulent academic institutions in pursuit of having people get real education, real academic training. And that's, you know, and that can be done. You know, I mean, that can be, you don't, people don't, at that age, people aren't force fed an education. They need to hunger for it. And I think if you foster the right type of environment, most will. And not everyone, I said, not everyone is going to be a PhD or, you know, or not everyone's going to maybe is, should get a BA. Yeah. You know, they should, you know, identify their talents and their abilities and go from there. But right now, it's sort of a false economy, because the university system is heavily subsidized through government guaranteed loans and these things. And of course, all that, it's made it easier for people to go to college, but it's also made it increasingly unaffordable. So they're heavily in debt, which then again speaks to perhaps another scam going on here. It's a pathway towards debt slavery, debt bondage, and you look at your local university as sort of a predatory lending institution now.
You know? Exactly, I mean, that's what it is. That would be a step up, because it's a predatory lending institution that has mind control as its primary product.
Mm-hmm.
So it enslaves and it also, you know, creates both intellectually and also financially.
That gets in what they teach. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's just preposterous. I mean, it's destructive basically in all ways. And just going back to my point, since none of these universities, supposedly these independent institutions, blew the whistle on the MK Ultra programs that were going on in their institutions, right, for over a decade, then you can see that the whole system is completely corrupt. It's a cesspool, and that the tenure system must be part of this, so that the university professors you're getting are in some way tainted. In other words, and I know this is a broad stroke, but I would just say it's a true statement that the professors that the kids are experiencing, to one way or another, and to one degree or another, are tainted. They are basically there for a purpose. They have been selected somehow for some nefarious and oligarchic purpose. And so the first thing you want to do is get the hell away from these people, mm-hmm. right? There isn't, people on campus in positions of power that are for the people, because if they were, then someone, remember, there would have been thousands of these individuals who would have known that this thing was going on. Someone would have blown the whistle on MKUltra. They didn't. They accepted it. That means that there is a system of control over these institutions that is malevolent, right? And is secret.
But Joe, Noam Chomsky's an academic. Come on.
Yeah, I know. So there it is. You see, that's my point. As much as I have, tried to point out Noam as a lifetime actor, I'll bet you there are basically hundreds of these kinds of characters buried to one extent or another inside the universities. And so, the university is a cesspool. And this is, something that people really should actively avoid rather than try to participate in. The problem, of course, is that in many instances, there are some relationships between employment and, in academics, like being a lawyer. You want to be a lawyer, you got to go through this process,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But again, you have now this online option. Mm-hmm. And the young generation, the new generation, the internet generation, in my opinion, would be well served to try to just start replacing these functions. In other words, we don't really need the Democrats or the Republicans. Both of these organizations are beyond corrupt, right? They are simply unworkable for a citizen. It's impossible to get anywhere with these institutions. You need to replace them completely. And I would say the same thing is true with the American academic, the higher education. It's just too corrupt to do anything with whatsoever. A layperson could never negotiate their way through the thing, get any real value out of it, be sure of getting any value out of it. So you just have to try to replace the whole thing, and the young generation would be well served to simply figure out how to do that. The skills and tools are there, right? With the internet, with the online lectures. I mean, I've been, mm-hmm. like, in the last couple of years, I've been really getting into a lot of lectures about, things that you would never, know that you would need to know how to do. Like, I learned how to install a electrical charging system for my electric car,
mm-hmm.
right? Well, I didn't go to school. I just got on YouTube and some guy just walked me through it. And after a while, I could do it and I could show someone how to do it. And so, not an electrician, but I have a little tiny skill in this area. Well, this can be applied on a broad scale. And this is what people need to do. They need to vocally expose the universities as a cesspool. I think this is something that every high school student should be encouraged to do. There should be clubs called We Will Not Participate in the University Cesspool.
Yeah.
This would be a good.
The big impediment to that, again, is inertia and what people have been trained to think of, what they expect from college. I mean, looking back at the movies like Animal House, like late 70s, and how that was a generation, that was the baby boomer generation. Of course, that was reflecting back on the early 60s at a college. I believe 62 or something years that's supposed to take place, but these movies, Revenge of the Nerds, whatever these college movies, the exploited college movies, with the sex and the human, that sort of thing.
Well, and then the drugs and the alcohol.
So this is the lure for most people. What's funny is that one generation that was lured to college with promises, with expectations of easy women and alcohol and booze parties and these things. And then, they grow up, have kids, and they send their kids to college. They themselves are sort of morally compromised by it all, So this is a sort of the unfolding process of the sexual revolution. One generation is, engages in degenerate behavior, and they lack the Well, the emotional stability, the maturity, and also just the moral authority to restrict their own kids, and it gets worse and worse and worse. And pretty soon you have, polymorphous sexual identity problems, things like that, because sure. They're all come from broken families. They have no positive examples how they should behave as male and female and these things, and just the sheer cultural aggression that's been waged by the entertainment industry, Hollywood, and these things. So, but nevertheless, so people, they want to go to college. Your average high school kid probably thinks going to college, okay, this is my chance to go get out of the house and party, And that's been built over several generations. But although it's a relatively recent thing, probably since the 70s, as far as it being a sort of a cultural meme. If I have that correct.
Well, before World War II, the vast majority of college students, particularly, freshmen, sophomore, they would live at home. They'd go to local colleges. Mm-hmm. I would say that the oligarchs know perfectly well that, a moral culture is difficult to control, one that has, moral structure to it. And so what is the creator and embodiment of the morality that we've had, in our culture? Well, it's the family.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a family, you have the capacity for, highly moral individuals, highly independent individuals, right? And mm-hmm. particularly when you combine that with, a community, right, that they can relate to. And so I would just point out that the degree that, the family has been broken down would be the degree that the moral degeneracy has increased. I think the two are not just correlated, but are basically the same thing. And so when you look at the statistics of family production, I actually knew this, but a senior moment, or I'm forgetting, but before 1950s, a really high fraction of women would be married at the end of the 4 years of college.
Yeah.
Right. Production. Now I'm betting, gosh darn it, again, senior moment, but I think it's less than 2%.
So you've had
a total evaporation of one of the most important cultural phenomena. And this is all obviously deliberate. Look at Gloria Steinem's connection to the CIA. It's just, if you want one piece of, evidence. And so you've got a long-term plan to basically turn the university into, something that would just be a anti-family, organization. That's all they are. And
that's very important, because I talked to my young girls in the early 20s, nieces, and going to college. There's no talk of marriage and family. It's all about jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
And career.
And there's no talk because there's no hope of obtaining it. It's that rare.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is how successful the walk through the institutions was by the cultural Marxists. And you know something, Tim? And this, I get angry when I think about this, but this shouldn't surprise anybody, because before you had the Frankfurt School and the production of cultural Marxism, you had Gregor Lukács' tenure as the cultural commissar of the Hungarian Soviet in 1920. And there you saw the future, right? There you saw the destruction of the family and the encouragement of pansexualism, whatever that is, and also of the shattering of basically the sense of reality of young people because of a forced education in fairy tales. Every afternoon, they trooped 20,000 kids for fairy tale lectures because they wanted specifically to break down their idea that they were human beings, right? And this isn't, a paranoid delusion. This is stuff that every person out there can do the research and verify. This was the beginning of the cultural Marxism, which then took over the American university. Right there. So when you see the lack of families, this was the intent, and this was their victory over us.
Yeah, and this was, you see it in the cultural Marxist agenda being played at universities, because we mentioned how they infested these growing institutions in the 50s and 60s, the post-war period. At this time, they're promoting things like polymorphous perversity and these sexual liberation, and to bring about the very thing that we see today is the breakup of the family, the decline of fertility rates, and sort of just the outlook or expectations of people now are so far different than they were 30, 40 years ago, and they see their own enslavement as liberation.
And this is the thing, and we talked about this in the last couple shows, that people need to change their vocabulary. Instead of these terms that they've given us, which are terms that actually are designed to break down the family, sexual liberation, doing your own thing, this kind of stuff, they need to replace all of this vocabulary with one simple expression, which is easy to enslave, because that was what was in back of it. That was definitely 100% what was in back of Gregor Lucas's programs when he was the Commissar of the Hungarian Soviet. And that was 100% what was in back of the Frankfurt School when they were designing all of this march through the institutions to end up with, basically an individual that would, as they first described it, would be compatible with, the Politburo and Marxism, right? But they quickly abandoned all of that when they moved the cultural influence into the United States post-World War II. So, the university is, I think it's something that every American should study, the general statistics of it over the last 60 years. Try to have an explanation as to how this occurred. Because obviously, you can say, well, history unfolded. Rock and roll music, drugs, sexual liberation, these things were just, Americans were bored. And so this was a, adventure. It was just something kids wanted to do. It stuck. It got into our culture. And now, there's no family production. Okay, that's one explanation. But you really believe that the people that were creating the universities, the people who were designing the new curriculum, that they had no agenda, you see? I think the existence of MK Ultra and of the relationship between MK Ultra and the university should, if nothing else, make people want to wonder a little bit about this stuff. Don't you think so too?
Well, yeah, exactly. And if you just study the careers of Edward Bernays, the nephew of the double nephew of Sigmund Freud, all this the sort of the psychoanalysis and the psychological studying of human nature, these things have been so refined, and it's been almost become a science, and there's a book called A Science of Coercion by Christopher Simpson, and he focuses a lot of attention on the of course the Research Radio Project out of the Research Radio Project of
Princeton.
Princeton University, and of course this plays into the War of the Worlds broadcast. This is the late 1930s, the War of the Worlds broadcast, but just the role that mass communication and the opportunities that it afforded the social engineers. And the mass communication itself was developed for the purposes, not of education, not as innocent entertainment. It was developed for purposes of mass mind control and psychological manipulation and psychological warfare. I mean, these things that, again, it's not just an accident, that entertainment, music, and these things would go a certain direction and promote certain, outlooks or views of the same way we look at like the Time Life Empire, Henry Luce, and these things, and or the fact that if you look at Operation Mockingbird, and I just did I had a conversation about that a couple of nights ago. If you look, every big name in broadcast journalism, news, entertainment, print media, they're all on the payroll of the CIA.
It's unbelievable.
Stuart Alsop, Walter Winchell, William Perley,
Walter Cronkite. I mean, the thing is so amazing. You know, it's I had another discussion about this a little while ago myself, and I was kind of, I couldn't get this point to be agreed to, but I was pointing out, look, they didn't go out and hire the big names. They made the big names.
Yeah.
Do you see the difference there? Mm-hmm. It would be impossible to say, well, we're going to go out and capture the top 1,000 journalists and broadcasters in America. There'd be rebellion. There'd be resistance. You'd have some news story to pop up. The only way you can pull that off is to put them in place already formed. So this is the point, is this is how you can see how the secret society is in operation and how these people are coming into positions of media power because of their relation to the secret society and the oligarchic control. That insight is just absolutely critical for understanding the reality that American citizens face.
Yeah. And to speak directly to the university itself, I think it was Charles Beard, the kind of leftist renegade historian in the early 20th century, he spoke of, he was approached in the early part of the 20th century and asked if he would start teaching history in a way that was consistent with the interest of the oligarchs, promoting collectivism, these things, teach a type of history that would allow for their agenda to proceed, which would be, centralization of power, collectivism, promotion of war, these things that lead to their ever greater power. And he told them to go fly a kite. It won't be bought off. And it was at that point that they determined that, well, they wouldn't bother trying to buy him off. What they would do was endow universities with chairs, buy out the American Historical Association, and give those positions to those up-and-coming academics who wanted to be historians, wanted to do well. And they would reward them with the positions, universities, the chairs, the tenure. And within a generation, they would have taken over the American the history profession at the universities. So a certain history would be taught. And so that's how it's done. That's how it was done, according to Charles Beard. And that's kind of how it's done. They created the big names in history. And that is why today, if you take a history course in a university about modern American history or political history, you will learn that John F. Kennedy was shot by a lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald. You will learn that Pearl Harbor was indeed a sneak attack, and these things, learn these things, and you won't get any, and you'll get the official narrative. Whereas if you just go out to your local bookstore or order a book online, you'll read a few books and you realize just a few articles, realize both those narratives, both those accounts are ridiculous. And so that's why we're in the situation we're in at the university, because it was bought out a long time ago. And even if they couldn't buy out an academic, they create their own universities, like University of Chicago or Vanderbilt University, right?
London School of Economics.
London School of Economics, yeah.
So these things are basically oligarchic control from the very beginning, or they have been brought under the wing of them through the endowment system. And so now, even if there was free minds that wanted to rebel, at this point above them is the entire financial world and universe that these systems operate within. Mm-hmm. So there's just not, any way, that you can rebel against them. And that's why, by God, Tim, the thing that, Americans should be encouraging their kids to do is to develop their own university.
Yeah.
Use the internet in the same way that we need to use the internet to create a new media, the media being too corrupt to change in any way. We need to create a new university. And this can be done. The tools are there to be able to do this. And this is really the hope that we can offer is that, you don't need to spend the $200,000 to go to Indoctrination U. Forget mm-hmm. that. If your parents are going to scrape together the 200 grand, tell them to save it. Say, please put that money in the bank. I'm going to need it in a few years because I'm going to get into a business or start a new life or develop a family. Mm-hmm. That money I cannot think of anything worse to do with that money than put it into someone's university system, or university education at this point. And then the idea of coming out in another way of like the debt of saying, well, go ahead and just borrow the 200 grand. If that's the path, absolutely forget this. This is insanity. This is paying for your mental enslavement.
Mm-hmm.
Just forget that. Use the tools out there. And if you're having hard times, that you can go online. There are actually kind of blogs and different internet communities that are trying to develop university skill training right now.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do this. There are very few professions. There's only, like I said, lawyer and doctor. Well, you don't want to be either one of those anyway. So use the internet to develop your own skills. Save your money for investment in yourself, not in the university system.
Yes, exactly. So, well, I think we covered it, Joe.
I do, Tim, and this has been a real pleasure, and I hope to talk to you at the same time 1 week from today, if that's all right, because we'll be traveling in some other exotic part of the world, and hopefully over the next 7 days there'll be no more disasters for
pray for
Montecito, yeah. Because we're getting a little tired of that. Anyway, Tim, been a pleasure talking to you, sir, and I'll talk to you in a week.
Great. Enjoy.
All right. Thank you, sir. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.